This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning and welcome to a special extended edition of The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanisan. Income inequality has become a hot topic in politics, and we see it in the run-up to the 2020 elections as the Democrats talk about different ways to tax the rich and universal basic income. And here in Malaysia, with the government launching its own shared prosperity vision as it aims to tackle the issue of poverty in the country. To discuss the current state of inequality and poverty, I have in the studio with me Professor Dr. Martin Ravalion, Edmund D. Villani Chair of Economics at Georgetown University. He's also the current visiting chair for the Unku Aziz Center for Development Studies at University Malaya. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Professor, let's start off with how do we differentiate between inequality and poverty? Because this is a concept that is often confused with one another.
That's right. Inequality is about the differences, the disparities in levels of living. It's not about the absolute levels of living. Poverty, of course, is about the absolute levels of living of poor people. In particular. So you can think of poverty as an aspect of inequality. One of and equally well, you can think of inequality as an aspect of poverty. The two are very strongly connected, but they're not intimately connected. You can have a situation of rising inequality with falling poverty and vice versa.
So when we look at economics in general, now we've gone through decades of growth. Mm-hmm. How does that relate to the situation of poverty and inequality in not just Malaysia, but the world?
Most countries, most of the time when countries grow for a sustained period of time, we see falling absolute poverty rates. Absolute poverty defined in terms of a fixed poverty line over time. It's very unusual to see rising poverty rates during spells of economic growth. It does happen. But the variance is large. We've got some countries where you see rapid poverty reduction with economic growth, other countries where you see very little progress against poverty with economic growth. Malaysia's been a country that's been very successful from this point of view. I mean, absolute poverty rate has fallen from the official rate from 50% 50 years ago to virtually zero now, 0.4% in 2016. And that's not just due to economic growth, although economic growth has been hugely important. The other factor has been falling inequality. And Malaysia is actually the only country I know where we've seen over a 50-year period a trend decline in inequality. Not huge, but over 50 years, it's pretty big. It goes from a Gini index of 0.55 down to about 0.40 now. Most countries would be very envious of Malaysia from that point of view.
We're going to dive into that a little later in the interview. But mm-hmm. right now, when we look at modern economics today, is there a mismatch between the way we quantify growth and the way that we look and measure poverty and inequality?
Yeah. One of the things that struck me in recent years is the disconnect between the way economists talk about poverty and inequality and most people, many lay people talk about poverty and inequality. And I'm really struck by this. And it's kind of important because if economists have a language, a set of concepts that it doesn't match the way people think about those ideas, then we become irrelevant. And that's not real good. But what am I talking about specifically? Well, inequality, let's start with that. The way most economists, and almost all economists, define inequality is in terms of ratios of incomes, right? Proportionate differences in incomes. And that's very natural. But when I talk to people and when I survey people, including my students at Georgetown, I find that many of them, possibly half, don't think about inequality in those terms. They don't think about the ratios of incomes. They think about the absolute differences, the idea of the gap between the rich and the poor. And that's a monetary gap, you know, ringgits of difference in absolute levels of living. They look at that. They don't look at the ratio, right, which doesn't depend on the currency and the level of the currency, obviously. So they think about absolute inequality in terms of absolute gaps in living standards, and they see those absolute gaps every day. in some sense, you don't see the relative gaps. You have to make a calculation. You have to make a ratio.
So an example would be, I think if I saw one of your notes, it is if I ask someone the difference between, if I gave you a set of numbers, 1, 2, 3 and 2, 4, 6, which is more unequal.
Yeah.
Right. In relative terms, they are the same.
Exactly.
But in absolute terms, there is a larger gap in the 2, 4, 6 set of numbers.
That's right. And when I show exactly those numbers and others to people, half the time people will say that the 2, 4, 6 is more unequal because they see the difference between the 2 and the 6 as, you know, 4, rather than they don't look at the, rather than the ratio. The ratio is the same, 1, 2, 3, 2, 4, 6. The ratios are identical.
So is there a correct way to look at inequality then?
It's not that one is correct and one is wrong. It's just two different ways of thinking about it. Economists don't have a right and wrong answer there. It's what's called an axiom. There are different axioms of inequality measurement, but we don't need to go into that. The point is that it's not that one is right and one is wrong. They're two different concepts. The really important thing is that you understand which concept you're using and which concept the person you're talking to is using. I've seen this personally many times. This is what triggered it, in fact. When I worked in the field, I would go to a village and I'm talking to somebody, maybe a local NGO or somebody in the village, and they're seeing the absolute gaps in living standards over time, and they're seeing rising inequality, and I'm doing the calculations and I'm seeing falling inequality, and we kind of have to understand each other if we're going to have a meaningful dialogue.
And I guess that explains the reason for why there is a disagreement about inequality in the world or even poverty, in the differentiation between over time.
That's right.
Because if we're using absolute numbers, then it looks like inequality is growing, but if you're using relative numbers over time, inequality has dropped.
That's right. Globally, using relative inequality, globally, this is surprising to some people, but we've seen a downward trend in global inequality. Now, what does that mean? Global relative inequality and ignoring the countries of residence. So we just pool all people in the world. So obviously what's driving that is the growth in China particularly, now India joining that. Over a sustained period, obviously recent threats to that in India, but we're starting to see a rise in the levels of living of the poorest countries, and that overall process of convergence in average living standards is driving down global inequality, but global relative inequality.
See, this reminds me of the elephant graph that was made famous, yes, I think, by Branko Milanovic, the former World Bank economist. And if you're not familiar with the graph, it basically showed that that globalization had led to the rich getting richer, but mm-hmm. also the lifting of the middle classes in emerging markets like China, India, and Brazil. But where people were left off were the very poorest and the middle-income people in the richer nations, they were also left behind. So how does globalization fit into your thinking of inequality and poverty?
Mm-hmm. In a funny way, I think, you know, in some ways, globalization has been blamed for too much. it's really part of a story, but it's just part. It depends, of course, what you mean by globalization, but the way most people talk about it, they're talking about global trade. The volume of trade globally is rose for a long period, starting to stabilize, even fall. It's been a factor. It's been a factor in the growth of a number of previously low-income countries, but it's not overwhelming. For example, China, I mentioned before. China's growth has been hugely important globally and, of course, to China, but the bulk of the poverty reduction was not from trade. It was from agrarian reforms. It was from agriculture and rural development, lifting the rural poor. Now, of course, that process required labor absorption into urban areas, into jobs. And many of those jobs were in export-led manufacturing. There's no doubt about that. But it's not it's part of a story, right? And to say that it's all about globalization is really deceptive. In fact, you can make arguments that trade reform is in some countries has been inequality increasing, some countries inequality decreasing. It really depends on the initial conditions in the country. And trade in particular is one of those things that it's really hard to imagine could it be otherwise, because trade is not something where, you know, all of the poor gain and all of the rich or all of the rich lose or vice versa. Even amongst the poor, some will gain and some will lose. You'll have these horizontal differences. And that's very important because a lot of the reactions, popular reactions in the media and in the population at large, are about those horizontal differences. Mm-hmm. There are urban versus rural poor, for example, who could be affected very differently. They're equally poor, but affected very differently by trade reform.
So let's talk about the common narrative. Globalization has been blamed for because of the job losses in developed nations and those jobs being moved over to developing nations like China, that the rich have gotten richer from this. Corporations have been able to increase their profits and all of that. How big of a factor has this been to the increase in absolute inequality?
Definitely, it's been a factor, and the rising non-competitiveness of global capitalism is a serious concern. I think we should all worry about this. I mean, Adam Smith would turn in his grave. I'm a great fan of Adam Smith, but he was an advocate of competitive capitalism, not the sort of thing that's happening now. And a number of people are conscious of this, there's no doubt. And there is a definite connection between the emergence of this new form of monopoly capitalism globally and the upward pressure on inequality in some countries, relative and absolute, definitely. The two are connected, often through the politics. You know, we're seeing a rising in a high-end inequality, which is actually starting to undermine welfare states in many countries, including the United States. A lot of pressure, for example, on the food stamp program in the US coming right now, which is a very good program from the point of view of poverty reduction, but is being cut, work requirements and so on. A lot of that pressure is coming from a very powerful top income stratum of the United States, US society, which is undermining a lot of things that have produced the progress in the country in the longer term. This is a serious worry.
We're going to continue this discussion in just a little bit. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. Stay tuned.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Good morning and welcome back to a special extended edition of The Breakfast Grill. You're with me, Roshan Karnason, and in studio with me, Dr. Martin Revelyon, Professor of Economics at the Georgetown University. Now, Professor, when we look at inequality, I think you've made the point before that it's both ethically and morally an issue, and that there are costs that we are not paying attention to. What are the costs related to inequality?
You know, when I was teaching economics 15 years ago, I probably would have said not much. Inequality is not something that inequality could actually be generally positive for economic growth. That's not a saying we tolerate inequality. That's just saying there could be a trade-off. Now, I don't think I'd say that, and I think the bulk of the research is pointing in a somewhat different direction, really saying that inequality, certain types of inequality, are particularly bad for aggregate economic growth. And that's really a change in views, and it's a change that's come out of evidence. I mean, economic theory doesn't predict that inequality is good or bad for economic growth. It's really a matter of looking at the evidence. And when we do, we see many situations where high inequality countries have a particular impediments to economic growth and especially to pro-poor economic growth. A lot of that coming out of market failures, particularly in credit markets, where many poor people can't get access to credit. Some of them have got very good ideas for investment and they can't finance those investments, including in education. Very important. The credit market failures are common across the world, but they particularly hurt poor people. So you can get a situation where, given the nature of the market, the markets and the way they work in a particular real situation, inequality in the number of poor people you have and the amount of inequality you have can impede overall economic growth, as well as being quite separately to our ethical concerns about inequality, which remain.
I think that's the one of the concerns today, right? Because it's the perpetuating story of if you can't get access to credit, if you can't get access to education, that absolute gap between the rich and the poor will widen over time.
Yes.
Global inequality has come down, but within countries, you've had that inequality widen. Do you have an idea or at least a theory of how that's going to look going forward?
Absolute inequality will almost certainly continue to rise. It's going to take a long time, decades, even with a fairly optimistic growth scenarios and continuing decline in global inequality, relative inequality, for absolute inequality to start to fall. It will at some point, but it's going to take a while.
Now, let's look closer to home. You're in Malaysia right now. You're with the Unku Aziz Center for Development Studies right now. You're a visiting professor there. And I have to ask the question, why are you studying Malaysia in particular?
Well, Malaysia's very interesting. I've always wanted to better understand the country's economic development, partly because as a foreigner, you look at Malaysia, it's a success story in many of the headline issues. Absolute poverty reduction, as I said, declined from 50% by using the official poverty lines, 50% over 50 years ago to virtually zero now. A long-run trend decline in inequality. This is, many countries, most countries would be very envious of Malaysia's success from that point of view. So I tried to understand that. One of the interesting things, I know the economic history. Co-author, an old friend of mine, Sudhir Anand, wrote a book about inequality and ethnic inequality included in Malaysia from using data from around 1970. And we all knew the economic history and followed it from a distance. When I arrived, the first visit about a year ago, I was quite surprised that people were still talking about that, the ethnic inequality issues. I thought that was pretty much over. No, it's not. It's still there. And I think it goes back to that difference I made between absolute and relative inequality, because when I look at the numbers, I do see convergence between ethnic groups, meaning that the Bumiputra Putra have seen higher rates of growth in their average income than the Chinese. So they're starting to see the ratios falling. Mm-hmm. That's the convergence we're seeing racially. That's terrific. That's good. But when I look at the absolute gaps, they're rising over time. Okay. So in some sense, again, you can look at the same reality, the same data in two very different ways. I was expecting to see that convergence, people not talking about ethnic inequality as much as they did before, and that may well be true. But the amount of the discussion and attention it still gets, I think, relates to that rising absolute gaps in living standards. And that will probably continue.
So two different people could look at that data and come up with two different headlines, exactly. Essentially, that one inequality has come down and another one inequality has gone up.
And again, it's not that one is right and one is wrong. It's two different concepts. You just have to understand that. I'm a relativist. I fully admit, when I look at inequality, I look at the ratios. But I have to have a meaningful debate and discussion, we have to understand that other people don't agree.
So let's talk about the poverty line, because a few months ago, Philip Elston, the U.S. Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, brought up the issue that the fact that the poverty line has remained the same level for decades is an issue, that we're not measuring poverty accurately. How does this, I guess, correlate with the idea that we've seen poverty fall for the last 50 years?
And that was one of the first things I looked at a year ago. And one of the things that I was aware of and I want to look at more closely was the fact that Malaysia had kept the real value of the poverty line, the official poverty line, constant over this 50 years. And politically, it's very difficult to raise the real value of the poverty line. But with rising with the kind of growth and rise in average living standards we've seen in Malaysia, the same success we've talked about, with that growth, the idea of what poverty means changes. What it means in Malaysia now is not what it meant 50 years ago. That's obvious to anybody, right? So the concept of poverty has to adapt to the society, has to stay relevant. I don't believe the official poverty line in Malaysia from 50 years ago is of any real relevance today to the country. I've recalculated the poverty measures for Malaysia over a period from 1984 to 2016. I can't do it before 1984. Because the data's not available. But and that's a big problem in Malaysia. Access to public data is a serious concern. But from the data I can get, I can recalculate the poverty measures in a way that I think is much more sensible, where the poverty line adapts to the rise in average living standards in a sensible way. It shouldn't be proportional, in my view. It should rise with average living standards, I think, at about one slope of about 1 in 3. So for every 300 ringgit increase in the mean, about a 100 ringgit increase in the poverty line would be sensible, I think, and would bring it into line with the kinds of poverty lines we see in similar countries, countries with similar average incomes to Malaysia. A country like Malaysia, with its average income, we would expect a poverty line about three times the current official line. The official line is the poverty line of a very poor country. It is not the poverty line appropriate to a country like Malaysia.
So the poverty line hasn't grown with the nation, basically.
That's right. When we look at similar countries in terms of average income, we find poverty lines about three times higher.
So with that readjustment, does that change our 50-year improvement over on poverty?
Good question. It modifies it in the following way. I still find a long-run decline in the poverty rate, and it's quite substantial. From 1984, about a poverty rate of 40% to about 20%, a little bit over 20% now. So a nearly halving of the poverty rate over that period is definitely success, and that's the relative poverty rate. The absolute poverty rate, of course, has fallen more substantially. But I think a poverty measure closer to, poverty rate closer to 20% is more in line with what poverty means today in Malaysia. But the success is still true. That is not changing.
So when we talk about inequality in Malaysia, I think we can't go too far without talking about the national economic policy introduced in the 70s. In your studies, how has that led into the change in inequality mm-hmm. in Malaysia? How has that fed into it?
Well, the bulk of the absolute poverty reduction, about three quarters, was produced by economic growth. And the growth process was really important here. It was a growth process that generated a lot of jobs. It generated a lot of good growth, a lot of equitable growth in the country, and that was really important. But it's not disconnected from what was happening to inequality. And that's important. I think the redistribution effort, when I say redistribution, I don't necessarily mean transfer payments. I mean a broader set of things, including access to better schooling, access to finance for supporting small and medium-sized enterprises, and so on, all of which had an affirmative action flavor for a long period coming out of the new economic policy. That was quite important. The other quarter of the poverty reduction was due largely to that. So Malaysia's success in reducing ethnic disparities was quite important to the progress against poverty.
But how does the the narrative that it has led to the bigger gap, the absolute inequality in this country, because the so-called unintended consequences of the NDP not being beneficial to the target poor, mm-hmm. how is that?
Well, the absolute gap would have been even larger without the new economic policy. That's really clear. The new economic policy, I think, generated a lot of the process of inequality reduction. Quite possibly the bulk of it. I mean, it's very hard to determine that. It's not an easy question at all. But when I look at the numbers, certainly the reduction in ethnic relative inequality accounts for basically all of the reduction in overall inequality. There's not much left due to inequality, reductions in inequality within groups. It's largely reductions in inequality between ethnic groups. It's pretty much run its course. I don't think there's much further scope for ethnic redistribution as a means for poverty reduction, at least with the absolute poverty numbers. Well, that's no surprise because the absolute poverty numbers have fallen to such a low level. I don't think Malaysia should relax fully about the ethnic issues. I think they'd remain, the ethnic disparities remain, and they were. But how much more leverage you can have through that those kinds of policies is not quite clear to me.
And this is all based on, of course, relative standards.
Yeah.
We're going to continue this discussion in just a little bit. You're tuned in to an extended edition of The Breakfast Grill. Stay tuned.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to an extended edition of The Breakfast Grill. You're with me, Roshan Karnason, and in studio with me, Dr. Martin Revelyon, Edmund D. Villani Chair of Economics at Georgetown University. He's also the current visiting chair for the Unku Aziz Center for Development Studies at University of Malaya. Now, Professor, a big thing that's generally we look at here in Malaysia is the social welfare system. We're trying to make it better. And there have been concerted efforts in that department, in that area. How important are social assistance programs in alleviating poverty?
Oh, very important, no question. But also in the right sort of social assistance programs should be very complementary to a pro-poor growth strategy. A lot of the worries people have had about welfare policy have really been exaggerated. A lot of the critiques going back 200 years have exaggerated concerns about incentive effects, I believe. They're not as important as people often claim, critics of welfare policy. But nonetheless, you can't ignore incentive issues, and you want to avoid very high marginal tax rates on poor people, obviously. You want to be careful about excessive emphasis on targeting poor people. This can be damaging to good welfare policy. Targeting is not the objective. Poverty reduction is the objective. Targeting may be appropriate as a means. It may or not be. It depends on the costs. I think we've seen an exaggerated emphasis on targeting, too much emphasis on incentive effects, but nonetheless, making sure that you don't do really stupid things with incentive effects. I mean, 100% marginal tax rates on poor people induced by perfect targeting is really a dumb thing to do, all right? And don't do that. At the same time, I also would be skeptical about universal basic income in Malaysia. I think you can do better than that. I'm not a fan of universal basic income, but I'm not a staunch critic either. I think in some circumstances it's the natural benchmark to ask, can you do better than a universal basic income from the point of view of reaching poor people?
So what does that look like? What looks better than a universal basic income?
Well, if I'm France, for example, France has a well-developed, well-administrated welfare state, which does better than universal basic income, or it's my impression. There are many countries that can do better than that. Australia, my country. If you have the capability, it's all about state capacity. If the government has the ability to do better than universal basic income, meaning that poor people receive larger benefits than non-poor people in absolute terms.
So we're talking about not just giving out cash, but infrastructure.
Oh, everything. Oh, absolutely.
Education, healthcare.
Absolutely, yes. And this is really important because the way I like to think about it, we should be talking about universal basic full income in some sense, where that includes imputed values for education and healthcare. This is another thing that worries me about a lot of the discussion, particularly around transfer payments and basic income, that I kind of worry it's going to divert attention from basic health and education, which I see is hugely important. And poor people all over the world agree with me, I think. It's really a potentially worrying distortion away from the emphasis on human development. Cash transfers to poor people are part of the package, but if you're really going to make progress in pro-poor growth and promoting equitable growth, it's going to have to include dealing with poor levels of quality of education available to poor people everywhere, and Malaysia included.
We were talking about this earlier. The lack of access to credit markets and education perpetuate the cycle of poverty. And if we don't tackle these two, there's only so much money you can throw at something.
That's right.
And having that basic infrastructure can help people get themselves out of poverty
That's
in the longer
right,
run.
Yeah. It goes back to your very first question, I guess, about inequality. In some ways, maybe the word inequality is just too big a word. Mm. And we really have to unpack it. And what are we talking about that really matters here? And I think first order, inequality of opportunity. And actually, unlike poverty, one of the differences poverty and inequality is for poverty, we do have a consensus. Who's going to say we shouldn't eliminate poverty? Mm-hmm. For inequality, we don't have a consensus at present. And I'm not sure doubt if we ever will have it. But for some aspects of inequality, we can build a consensus to move forward politically. And inequality opportunity is one of them. That we, across left and right, you'll get a broad degree of agreement that there's too much inequality of opportunity, poor people don't have the same opportunities for advancement as non-poor people, and we should be doing something about that. And that's, again, getting back to assuring good quality basic health and education available to everybody, including the poor. If we don't do that, none of this will really be very successful.
If you had to choose between cash transfers to the poor or establishing good basic education and healthcare facilities?
I wouldn't say that we don't. You only do one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a useful mixture.
So not for being example, absolute about it.
For example, yeah, that's right. For example, if you're a poor family and you may have a good school down the road, and you probably don't, but imagine you did. You were very successful in the education policy. You've got a good school with good teachers who are present and teaching well, et cetera. But, you know, you're facing a huge financial burden. Another year in school for your children or for your eldest son or daughter, maybe, could be a big financial loss. You know, they could be earning, bringing money in, helping to feed the family. You're facing a really difficult choice there. It's a choice about poverty now, poverty in the future. It's an intertemporal choice that is very difficult for the family to make. A little bit of help there would be great. Yeah? To reduce, in a sense, reduce the cost that they face in keeping the kid in school for a bit longer. Right? At that margin, for poor families, that can be quite important, that price they pay for schooling, which includes the foregone income of the child, of a young adult in some cases.
Now, when we look at different ways to... a lot of this comes down to funding,
mm-hmm.
right? Nations are figuring out how to fund social welfare programs, how to fund their schools. And one of the ideas that's come about, and I think this is something that's being talked about even in the U.S. Democratic mm-hmm. debates, is wealth taxation. Do you have a view on this? Is it something that we need to be looking at?
Yes. I think, okay, in the U.S., you've got to realize that I think mistakes were made. The shift away from progressive income taxes or the reduction in taxes on the rich was a mistake, in my view. You've got to think about how to correct that, right? One way would be a wealth tax over the limited period of time. What I don't fully understand is why you would have a continuing wealth tax. Wealth taxes are kind of difficult to do. I would put more emphasis on fixing the mistakes, particularly in the income tax schedules. Mistakes meaning that it's not sufficiently progressive. That, I think, is quite important. The unequal taxation of capital income versus labor income is particularly important. There are a lot of simple mistakes that were made, all right, in my view. And it's not just about redistribution. It's also about efficiency. Fixing those mistakes should be, I think, the first order importance. Whether you also need a new tax on wealth, again, you could see that as a corrective for dealing with those mistakes. But introducing a new tax, which would be quite a complex tax, I'm not entirely convinced on the case. There's some very good people, Emmanuel Sayers, Gabriel Zucman, arguing for this, and I hear them. And I'm sympathetic with the objective, but I'm not fully convinced on the arguments.
So when we talk about welfare, how do we balance this idea of free markets versus
right
welfare?
Well, you know, I've said before, you know, I'm an advocate for redistribution, for reducing inequality, and I think that's the only way you're going to save capitalism.
Using redistribution to save capitalism.
Yep.
That is because eventually, if we don't do something about it, this will collapse. Capitalism will collapse upon itself.
I fear it might. And I do fear, because I think it is the best economic system we have. As I said, I'm a great fan of Adam Smith. But this is not, he would not be happy with the way things have developed.
The capitalism that he knew is no longer the capitalism.
Yes, that's right.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today. I think one of the most important threads we've pulled on is the importance of education,
mm-hmm.
affordable, accessible, good education for everybody, and how that will help at least reduce the perpetuity of poverty.
Agreed.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure and a very insightful conversation.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Professor Dr. Martin Ravelyon, Edmund D. Villani Chair of Economics at Georgetown University. He is also the current visiting chair for the Unku Aziz Center for Development Studies at University of Malaya. Martin will also be speaking at the Unku Aziz Development Forum on Inequality on the 15th and 16th of January. You can find out more in the link on the podcast show notes. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasan for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.